good to know. So, but you know, I've never talked about that, and it's the first. It's a new picture of gravity. It started for me a year and a half ago when I was in Japan, and it's inspired by the, you know, I was inspired by the beauty of Zen gardens. So I hope it will inspire you too. And this work is partly done in collaboration with Yuki Yokokura, who's a student at Kyoto University, but he's here. So let's say, you know, I want to talk together about non-equilibrium thermodynamics and quantum gravity. My talk is really going to be purely classical gravity, but in the background, it's going to be entirely classical gravity, but I really have a motivation, which is quantum gravity. And of course, in the Bronstein cube, you know, quantum gravity sits here, and thermodynamics really sits here. So you cannot think about two realms which are more opposed than these two ones. But, you know, so therefore you can ask what can be, you know, the relationship between these two different realms. And I'm trying, you know, that's essentially the question that I want to explore. So there seems to be some kind of evidence for a correspondence between black hole physics and, you know, gravitational physics and non-equilibrium and thermodynamics. But is it just an analogy or is it a deeper correspondence? And here I would like to argue, and it's moved towards arguing, that it corresponds to maybe a deeper correspondence that extends not only to static, thermostatic, but non-equilibrium thermodynamics. And if successful, I think it can, first, as you will see, it provides a beautiful picture of gravity and very physical picture of gravity. It can provide some kind of holographic or quasi-local holographic description of gravity. And eventually, you know, if there is some kind of fluctuation dissipation theorem, it can give us some new clue about quantum gravity constituent. So that's the motivation. I mean, one of the other motivations is something like, okay, we know that every perturbation of black hole finally settles down to a static spherically symmetric configuration, let's say, or axisymmetric configuration. But this is very analogous to the statement that if you take you know, a cup of coffee and you stir it like that, of course you cannot see through, but you know, it will finally settle down to an equilibrium configuration. So there is this question in the background that is the ringing down of black hole, you know, related to the process of relaxation to equilibrium, which is a process of thermalization. And this link together two of the most fundamental questions. You know, is it possible to understand, we understand the ringing down of black hole, but really from the point of view where we have asymptotic infinity, so we know the end of space, I would like to maybe devise a picture where we could understand that eventually quasi-locally. And in the same way, you know, the production of entropy production mechanism or relaxation to equilibrium is one of the most fundamental forefront subjects in non-equilibrium thermodynamics. What is the laws of physics behind relaxation? Okay. So another, you know, motivation for me is the nature of entropy. You're going to get talks by Alessandro Perez or Eugenio Bianchi saying that in loop quantum gravity, there's one way where we can count the number of states and get this entropy, or Eugenio has this new picture where maybe it's related also to entanglement entropy. But there's a puzzle when you look at this derivation, is that none of these derivations really depend on having a dynamical black hole. They're mostly fixed, you know, related to some kind of fixed surface in space. So they also point towards down that if these derivations have some physical meaning somehow, there should be the ability to assign entropy to any kind of region of space-time, which is the question I'm asking here. Is it really possible? Okay, so, you know, why do we believe there's maybe some relation with black holes? So it goes back to this laws of black hole, which is usually called thermodynamics, but they're really thermostatic laws of black hole, right? Black hole at equilibrium have a temperature. There's some kind of first law. If you change the mass between two stationary black holes, you get a contribution proportional to the area. There's a second law that for event horizon, the area always increase. And then this led people to identify some other area of the horizon to be the entropy and the surface acceleration here, kappa, to be some kind of temperature. Okay. So now the question, you know, that many people are interested in is that is really an entropy of something? Is there a way to assign some kind of entropical notion to an area of a region in space? And maybe this area is the black hole horizon. And in order to understand what entropy is, entropy really takes, at the classical level at least, its meaning when you think about out of equilibria. You know, entropy is the notion which is here to track down the flow of time. You go out of equilibrium, then you go towards equilibrium. And the process of going towards equilibrium is the process of production of entropy. So this is really what entropy is. Entropy should be, what you should worry about when you worry about entropy is the rate of production of entropy. Okay, so can we understand the process, of entropy production change in area of my region as some kind of process happening in a physical system? So let's say if we go back to the horizon, it means that we have now to, I want to go towards non-equilibrium thermodynamics. So we want the horizon to become a fully dynamical region. So now there's two pictures there. We can have either, a picture where the horizon is really some kind of event horizon, but the problem is that that's teleological. In order to talk about that, the nice thing about that is that I have a natural second law there, but it's a teleological picture where I have to end, attend the end of time to talk about what I'm talking about. And there could be an horizon crossing, in between us, the room right now, and we will never know before a billion years, maybe. So that's not really good if you want to do local physics. And I think there's been so much emphasis on this theological notion. They're beautiful mathematically, but okay. There's a better, for me, notion, which is that has been devised by Hayward and Ashtekar, and which is trapped and dynamical horizons. And this is, in some sense, more towards the philosophy I want, except that, such an horizon is really a space-like surface. And I want to go and describe a physical system. And for me, a physical system is going to span a world tube, which is a time-like world tube. So when I think of a physical system, let's say I want to do gravitational physics, all kind of physics in this room, right? This room is bounded by this, the boundary of this room. And I just want to know, and the surface of this room in time just span a time-like surface. So this is the kind of system I would focus on because I want kind of physical picture. So in some sense, it's inspired by the membrane paradigm that was developed by these people, but I think it's a bit different, or it goes beyond it. So then, if there is some kind of connection between gravity and thermodynamics, why would there be any connection like that? It's not true for any other type of matter that there exists. So there should be a reason for that. Gravity has to have something special about it. So what is so special about gravity? The thing which is so special about gravity that we all know is that gravity is holographic. What do I mean by that? It's essentially, the principle of equivalence that you can always eliminate locally the gravitational field. This means technically that, we have diffeomorphism invariance, and we can make arbitrary change of coordinate, arbitrary change of time. So the main conclusion of that is that essentially, if I ask you what is the energy of a closed system which contains gravity and all matter, you're going to conclude that it is zero. There is no bulk energy whatsoever. So anything I put, anytime I put some kind of energy, it's a radical statement if you think about it. Anytime I kick, I push, I burn, I do something, what happens is that the gravitational degrees of freedom rearrange itself exactly in the proper manner to completely eliminate any energy I put there. This is a very radical behavior. This is really what gravity is doing for us. Okay, so this is the introductory part. Now I want to go towards a more technical description. So I want to get a setup where, let's say, I can describe what is the physics in this room. So, which is, providing a quasi-local description of gravitational physics without referring to the end of space and the end of time, and see how far I can go with that. So the, let's say this room will be a region of space, bounded by an outer, maybe one inner or no inner or a few. So I, I choose a domain, and the boundary of these domains is the screen, which can have several components. Okay. Now, in order to define the energy, we need to choose on each of these screens. So this is my screen in space-time. You span a time-like region, and then there's maybe a slicing at a moment of time. I need to choose a notion of time. So I need to pick a notion of foliation and a preferred field of Eulerian observer. So essentially, I need to pick a notion of time flow and, a notion of foliation, which is a transverse to this time flow. And then the, I assume that the time evolution of the screen is a time-like surface. So I can think about the screen as some kind of generalized observer. Think of it as the boundary of this room, for instance. That's what it is. Okay. So now, if I have such a setup. Sigma t is the region. And here at the intersection, this is a two-sphere, and this is the world line of this two-sphere, which is going to be the screen. Okay? So the first thing to do is to, now that I have a definition of time flow, I'm going to define the canonical Hamiltonian of gravity plus all matter field. So if I look at the gravity part, so this is the setup also. I have a time slice, In this time slice, I have a normal vector field, and then I have some kind of a radial vector field, which is going to be radial, going away from the screen. And then on the screen, I might have another notion of normal and radial. And the angle between the two, there might be some kind of boost angle that appears here between the two. So I don't have to assume that the screen is tied up to my foliation in a natural manner. And then if you give me a Lagrangian, there is a general prescription to compute what is the Hamiltonian. So you apply that prescription, and it's always that the Hamiltonian is essentially the symplectic potential, which appear here, h pi, and pi is the excessive curvature, essentially, and h is the induced metric on the slice. There's also a component which is a purely boundary component that says that the boost angle is, conjugated to the area. And then there is the, Lagrangian here. So it's written in this form. Okay, and then you do this computation. So this is the definition, then you apply, this object on shell, and you find that the bulk energy vanish. So you get a purely boundary contribution. So the result of this computation is that you conclude that the total energy, by total I mean it contains everything. It contains the gravitational energy, matter field energy, all sorts of matter, right? There's no restriction on the type of matter. The total energy of the system is purely a boundary term. There's no bulk contribution whatsoever. Okay, and essentially it means that it's written like that as the integral. So if I have an energy which is proportional to something on the surface, this object is usually called surface tension. So we're going to talk about it. And what appears in gravity is that this object that appears here is in fact a surface acceleration. And there is an explicit formula for it, which shows that essentially, it corresponds to the time derivative, the derivative of the time field projected onto the plane, normal plane NS. So it looks a bit technical, but I will explain that it really corresponds to a radial acceleration. So it measures somehow the radial acceleration of the screen. Okay, and the convention here is that I always take S, so N is always a vector normal, time normal to my two sphere here, and S is a vector which is radial, which go, outside my screen, and it's directed inward. Okay, so this formula appeared, in the literature, but I don't think their interpretation has been really completely nailed down up to what I'm going to propose. So now, okay, I have a time vector here, and this time vector on the screen can have a normal component to the sphere and also a tangential component. So let me take this decomposition. This is something which is orthogonal to S and something tangential to S. So accordingly, this radial acceleration term here, or this energy, can be decomposed into something which depends purely on the normal component and something which depends on the tangential component. This object, which is the normal component, is going to be, and I'm going to call it a surface tension. I'm going to justify for you why I call that a surface tension term. And this is the angular momentum. So essentially, this decomposition tells me that the surface tension, I call it the surface tension because it's going to give me the mass of the region inside the screen. Okay, so the mass of the region inside the screen is defined by being a purely boundary term, which is the integral of the surface tension, over the boundary. And you can check that this definition agree with all definitions of mass you can think of, right? They agree with the black hole mass or Komar definition of mass if the vector is, if T is a T-killing vector field. It agrees with ADM mass if you take this object at infinity. It agrees with Bondi energy if you kind of take your screen to go null. And in fact, we're going to see it just agree with Newton energy in the Newtonian limit. So depending on the type of screen you get all type of energy that you have encountered in gravity. But yes, yeah, it might. So here I'm in a finite region. I'm in this room. So then. Yeah, you have to do the usual. I agree. So now the second piece here is going to be interpreted about the angular momenta. I'm not going to have time to talk about that because that's kind of a subject on its own to understand properly angular momenta. Okay, so let's look first at this surface tension term, the mass term. In fact, to understand why this is a mass, look at, okay, the first thing is that if you take the original definition I told you and massage it a little bit, you're going to find that this surface tension is really a radial acceleration. So I have a screen here, and I have some kind of slice, which is there. So there's two notions of acceleration I can think of. One is that I can think of the define the acceleration of the screen. An observer that follows the screen is going to have some acceleration. This is this part. And then I can think of some kind of Eulerian observer, something which is sitting, you know, at rest with respect to my foliation. It will also have an acceleration. And this surface tension is just the average of these two accelerations. So for instance, if my Eulerian observer is tied up to the screen, then it's just the acceleration of the screen together, okay? And the fact that there's two acceleration is not surprising, is that when you have a slice along a screen, it can do two things. It can slide, but it also can change its boost angle, right? And then these two motions are why you have two notions of acceleration. So if the screen doesn't, the slide doesn't slide, but just move, you still have an acceleration. Okay, so it reconciles all possible calculations where sometimes, you know, you have acceleration due to sliding, or sometimes you have acceleration due to boosting. But they are, you know, all together, they repackage themselves into surface tension. So what does it mean? Okay, and the surface tension is positive for outer screen and it's going to be negative for inner screen. And in that case, it's better to think about it as a pressure term, but I'm going to explain that. So what does it mean physically for the screen to possess a surface tension? Before I'm going to answer that, so the angular momentum here, the density of angular momenta is proportional to this object, which is the commutator of these two vectors. So it just measures the non-integrability of the orthogonal plane. There's a nice understanding of that. Okay, and then if I put the two together, yeah, what's nice is that even at this very naive level, you get, for a very general screen, some kind of thermodynamical relation. First, you get SMA relation, that somehow the mass is related to kappa A plus G phi, you know, which reminds of the SMA relation for a rotating black hole. And also, we're going to see that you can have a version of the first law where the variation of the mass is sigma delta A plus delta phi. And when I have a variation in energy which is proportional to the area, this is, as we're going to see, what we call a surface tension term. There's lots of assumption that goes into this derivation, which is that it has to be adiabatic and preserve internal energy. We'll see about that. This is a big, you know. Okay, so now I'm saying I'm in this room. There's absolutely no energy whatsoever in this room, really. If I take gravity into account, the only thing that exists is really, you know, the energy that exists on this boundary. So on this boundary, I have a density of mass, I have a density of angular momenta, and I have also a density of area. So in the picture, we think that area, or let's say area dot, is somehow some kind of entropy. So I'm going to call that the Hawking entropy production rate, right? And the goal is to show whether eventually this is really an entropy production rate or not. And theta here is the expansion of T. So now, you know, if I'm in a general screen and things are moving here, things are going to flow in and out of this room. And I'm going to have to track down what happens. And what I'm going to do is reformulate all of what happens inside the screen in terms of equations that are purely from the point of view of the boundary. Okay, so if I do that, I can write the non-conservations of energy, mass, momenta, and, you know, area purely from this two-dimensional perspective. And to give you the punchline, the take-home message is that this dynamics is absolutely equivalent to something that has been studied in non-equilibrium thermodynamics for, you know, 100 years. It's absolutely equivalent to the dynamics of non-equilibrium dynamics for two-dimensional viscous bubbles in the presence of Newtonian gravity. Okay. So in order to prove that, I need not only to assign, I've already said that the screen has a surface tension, but I need to assign to do dynamics, I need to assign a notion of internal energy. What is the internal energy of the screen? And I'm going, you know, the internal energy of the screen is embedded in a slice. I can define the theta r is the expansion rate in the radial direction, okay? And the claim is that minus theta r over 8 pi g is the internal energy of the screen. So I'm going to explain you that. It kind of appears in some early work of Israel, Bronner, New York, but not maybe with this sharp thermodynamical interpretation. So that's another key element. The screen has surface tension, it has internal energy, okay? And that's maybe the only thing you have to remember there, and it's very generic. And the internal energy has this form. Surface tension is acceleration, internal energy. So let me try to see why I can do that. And in the process of doing that, I came along the fact, I was inspired by a work by John Baez that says, I'm going to give you the simplest expression of Einstein equation. And I wanted to do better than him. I think he did not get the simplest expression of Einstein equation. I'm going to give it to you. And I have a bet with my daughter, which is 13, that she's entering high school next year. And like, you know, my goal is that I'm going to explain that to her, and she's going to understand Einstein equation. This is not an approximation. It's an exact formulation of Einstein equation that I can explain in plain English. Of course, my 9-year-old was jealous and said, oh, I can understand too. So I don't know about that. But. So let's say that I consider, let me go very fast right on that. But let's say I consider an area of free falling particle initially at rest. And this is a transversal look of this this particle. And then let me send some kind of energy through it. Okay, what's going to happen? Okay, so initially they're at rest. By the equivalence principle, I can always achieve that. If I send some energy through it, something is going to happen to this bunch of particles. They're going to be, you know, from flat, they're going to curve. This is the only thing that can happen to a transversal slice. So it means that at first order, the change of shape is a change of the curvature of the curve, which is 1 over r. If I take another look, another transversal look, I'm going to change 1 over r prime. Now, you know, by isotropy, the change of shape of the area is characterized by the average of the two, which is the curvature, okay? So what is the Einstein equation in plain English? It says that the rate of change of curvature, by curvature I mean this curvature, is proportional to the flow of transverse momenta. This is it. If you ask that for any little surface, you're done. You have Einstein equation, full Einstein equation. The only thing you have to add is that this coefficient of proportionality is universal and negative. And negative is that gravity is attractive. So this is Einstein equation in plain English. This is, you know, when I put some equation, this is the coefficient of proportion is minus 8 pi g. So now if I translate in equations, which would be more familiar to you, you know, rate of change of curvature is dt of theta. The flow of transverse momenta is the integral of the component of the stress tensor TRT across the little surface. And minus a pi g is the proportionality coefficient. You can show that if you have that for any small surface, this is the expression of the, you know, Einstein tensor. And then you have Einstein equation with an arbitrary cosmological constant. So Einstein equation is somehow, if you define epsilon to be this object, you see that Einstein equation is really equivalent to this energy conservation. The variation of matter is the same thing as the variation of this internal energy.
So around just an integration
constant. Yeah, it cannot be determined by this principle because it's only flow momenta. There's no static energy there. Okay, so now maybe surface tension, why surface tension? If you, you know, in order to keep the particle initially at rest in place, you need to provide them with some kind of radial acceleration. So there's going to be some kind of work term needed to do that. And the particle will tend to move away and they have to resist the pull of gravity. And this is really how you define, you know, surface tension is you push onto a trampoline and, you know, it pushes you back. So really transverse acceleration, it just gives you a feeling of why transverse acceleration is surface tension. Okay, so now what is the punchline? The punchline is that the non-conservation of this entity from the point of view of the screen are equivalent to non-equilibrium thermodynamics of viscous bubble. So let me write down what are the equations of a viscous bubble, a two-dimensional viscous bubble. So the first equation that you have to write is some kind of Navier-Stokes equation. It's essentially amounts to conservation of momenta, right? Momenta flow, there's a compressibility vector, there's a two-dimensional pressure term, and then you have viscous stress and external force. I'm going to walk you through that, okay? The second equation that you have to write is conservation of energy, first law, right? The variation of energy, of internal energy of the system is essentially PdV, P delta A, the pressure term, you know. Then there is a component that we're going to analyze, which is really an entropy production term, which is the product of stress. There's a viscous stress, and then a product of strain. The strain is essentially the how your velocity depends on position. And then eventually there's some heat flux. Okay? And then the last equation that you're, I think, not familiar with is called a Laplace-Young equation, and it's a dynamical version of Laplace-Young equation that controls the rate of production of entropy here. And the key term is here is that there's a surface tension term that appears, whereas before there's some pressure, and we're going to see that pressure and surface tension are related. Okay, and the main claim is that this equation I just wrote, which are familiar equations from non-equilibrium thermodynamics, are exactly equivalent to the gravity equation on the screen. So if I project Einstein equation radially, normally, or radial-radial, I get exactly these three equations. Conservation of momenta, energy, Laplace-Young. Okay, so let's see. What is the Young-Laplace equation back to the early 1900th century, which is the why we have surface tension? So maybe, yeah, okay, first maybe a word about surface tension. So surface tension is really due to the fact that objects have constituents. And it's due to the fact that this constituent can be polarized, right? And the polarization of this constituent creates this van der Waal attraction force. So if I have a constituent like that and I put it in the boundary, it's missing half is, you know, neighboring stuff. So it's just want to minimize as much as possible how exposed it is to the exterior, to the boundary. So that's why, you know, there is some kind of surface tension. And the sigma, the surface tension is really defined as being the energy that is needed to supply to the system in order to increase the area by one unit. So this is the work term you need to do, sigma delta A. And you see that this work term, if you think that A is like a two-dimensional volume, is like, you know, minus P dV, so it's really a two-dimensional pressure. Surface tension is minus dimension pressure. And it is responsible for many of the physics you see around you, you know, the physics of drop, of droplets, of bubbles, of pairs, of foam, of evaporation, of wetting phenomena, capillarity adhesions. You know, you can go around today, make a round, and I can show you many examples of surface tension. So one of the key questions of surface tension is Young-Laplace equation. It says, suppose I have an interface and it has some curvature, theta r, you know, the guy we already encountered, this internal energy. And then, you know, there's going to be a difference in pressure between, suppose I have a bubble like that, and there's a difference in pressure, P out and P in. Now, the difference in pressure when I go from outside to inside is going to be proportional to sigma times theta. And if the theta is positive, it means that the pressure inside is going to be stronger than the pressure outside. Okay, so this is, you know, why you pay a lot for a bottle of champagne, you know, which has a little bubbles, like six, you know, seven times smaller than a beer bubbles, and that's why it costs, you know, 10 times more, because the overpressure you have to create is 7 to 10 times more. Okay, and then if you have a small bubble, it will, you know, empty itself into a big bubble like that. Another thing is that if you have negative curvature radius, you get depression inside. This is the phenomenon of capillarity adhesion. You see here, I have kind of an inverted radius. So inside, I got a depression. This depression is so strong that I get two plates. They are stuck together. I cannot move them. Okay? It also explains the plateau relay instability. If you have, you know, here you see I have a little inverted curve. So depression inside. Here, I have a positive curve over pressure. It's an unstable system. The system necessarily cuts itself in droplets. And you can go on and on and on and on about this, how this simple equation explains so many different phenomena. Okay, another thing that surface tension is associated with is the wetting process, which is essentially that if you put a droplet somewhere, it's going to spread. And if the solid is more polarizable than the liquid, you know, the solid is going to pull on it and just liquid will spread. And if the reverse is true, you're going to have a nice droplet here. And you can explain capillarity rise and why, you know, insects can walk on water. Okay, the key ingredient also that you may not know is called Marangoni flow. So there's something very important in surface tension is that if you have a gradient of surface tension, it drives a flow in the interface, which is towards high tension. And this is an example. You took a droplet going to flow, and this is the equation here, which also shows that it's like an inverse, you know, a minus a pressure, because pressure goes to the other way. So for instance, you know, one thing is that you can put some soap inside a little boat. You know, soap lowers the surface tension, then the flow goes outside towards the water, it propels the boat the other way. Or one of the most beautiful phenomena is, you know, is the tiers of wines, which are related to that, which explains why you have to, you know, why you pay a high price when you go to a fine restaurant, because crystal has higher surface tension than glass, which is higher surface tension than plexiglass. So you pay for the surface tension. You also pay for the level of alcohol, a good alcohol, a gigondas. It's totally mixed, higher level of alcohol. You know, the two together means that, okay, you know, I have crystal, high surface tension going to create a film. Complete, my wine's going to completely wet the glass. Okay, now, because it's wet, the wine is going to evaporate. So on top of it, I only have water. Down I have wine. Surface tension water is higher than wine. Therefore, it creates a Marangoni flow, which sucks the wine up there. And then gravity just at some point kicks in and creates these droplets. And the wine cries because he has lots all this alcohol.
But in your case, you only have one medium, right, which is space-time.
So only one medium.
One surface tension.
So now let's do it. It's a unique, yeah, the system I have is a, you know, monovalent. So let me go back to gravity. So this was to give you a feel of what is the physics behind this object. So in gravity, now we can write exactly, I'm going to focus only on the conservation of energy. I could, you know, spend 1 hour on each equation the same way. But conservation of energy, because it's the one you're most familiar with. So I say there's, you know, I'm going to have a first law. For a general screen, this is always the case, which is delta U is minus PdA plus TdS plus delta E matter plus delta E Newton. We already saw that the system has an internal energy, which is this object, radial expansion, okay? And I'm working in 8 pi g unit, okay? Now we have seen that the pressure is the surface tension. So this is the radial acceleration, okay? Now the matter flow is the usual thing. If there's matter crossing my screen, you know, I have to take into account, it's going to change the energy. That's the integral of this object. I also have a notion of Newton flow because, you know, the norm of my time vector gives me a Newtonian potential. And if I have a Newtonian potential, I'm going to get a work term. And if my Newtonian potential depends on time, I'm going to get dissipation due to that. So these terms are kind of okay. Maybe this one is a bit new for you. And this one, you would say, oh, why? I thought that this guy was TdS, but I'm saying, no, this guy is. You see now, it's clear that this guy is not TdS. This guy is sigma dA. If I have surface tension, I necessarily have a work term proportional to variation of the area. Okay, so what is this guy? This guy is really related to entropy production. I mean, maybe you go back. If I have a viscous fluid, you know, the viscous fluid, I mean, the equations I explained to you earlier were equations for static fluid. But now if I have a motion of fluid and it's viscous, the viscous fluids will be characterized by two new data. First, it will have a viscous stress tensor, and it will have a viscous rate of strain tensor that track what the velocity is doing, okay? And then for one component fluid in a box, you can show that the entropy production rate is always, for any generic system, proportional to flux times force. This is the flux, this is the force. This is the contraction. And then there's a term, this is the flux of heat, and beta is the inverse temperature. And the second law of thermodynamics is that this object necessarily is always positive, okay? Now, if you want to talk about water, sand, mayonnaise, glass, iron, whatever, you know, what you're going to do is choose constituent equation. The constituent equations are essentially equations that say how the stress tensor is related to the flux. Okay, and by choosing this relation, you're describing the type of material you're talking about. Okay, so in this equation, there is this last term, and which corresponds to entropy variation, which is TdS term, which is proportional to theta times delta, the flux times the force. So we can say, okay, in gravity, what is the flux and what is the force? Now, in gravity, if I have a two-dimensional surface and I have two normal directions, so I have two notions of external curvature tensor, you know, depending on the time direction. And clearly, the rate of strain, which is the change of velocity, well, this is really the excessive curvature in the time direction because T is really like the velocity. So the derivative of T is like the derivative of velocity. That's easy. But then there's the question of what is the Newtonian force? And the Newtonian force is essentially related to the excessive curvature tensor in the radial direction. And we conclude that force is really, this is how that force is really a flow, but in this imaginary radial direction, if you were living on the screen. Okay, so essentially what we conclude is that the fluid entropy production, here I'm taking a fluid picture, it has entropy production, the fluid entropy production is really gravitational waves. This is the definition of gravitational waves there. Okay, so now what about, how many times do I have, 1 minute? So I could explain you what is the usual derivation and what do people do. Essentially, what do people do when they write the usual relationship is that they say, assume now that we focus on a process where no gravity production wave is produced, so this term drops, Newtonian variation drops, and I assume that there's no change in internal energy. Then of course I'm going to get that PdA is delta, you know, I'm going to get this equation, which you interpret as the Hawking variation. So this is most of the classical derivation of this relationship are always one version of this. But is that conclusive that, you know, does that allow you to conclude that A is the entropy? You would say, well, no, of course, because it would be the same thing. If I look at the only process that preserves the internal energy, we conclude that the pressure is the, you know, is the temperature. But so I would say the classical usually derivation are kind of weak. about the evidence that S is this age. So now, on the other hand, Hawking and Unruh radiation calculation are kind of stronger evidence that, we can assign some kind of notion of temperature to what I call so far surface tension. So is there a hint from non-equilibrium thermodynamics that this is the case? And there's one last equation that describes objects with a, boundary, which is called Gibbs equation. And this is why Gibbs invented the notion of Gibbs energy. But essentially, this equation says that the variation of the surface tension with respect to the temperature has the interpretation as, the entropy of the system per unit area. So, you know, if you think that the surface tension is just the temperature, it means that this entropy per unit area is 2 pi h bar. So maybe that's the full radiation, but it also suggests that maybe the general identification should be kind of nonlinear, as it would be in a, realistic system. Okay, so here I'm finished. This is the general, you know, I can extend this dictionary from thermodynamics to gravity to all the components, the momenta, the viscous stress, et cetera, et cetera. One thing which is deserves a talk on its own is how you identify velocity. And this is the summary. So here I wanted to show you very quickly, maybe too much, that due to its holographic nature, gravity in a box can be equivalently described in terms of boundary, the screen. The screen possesses a surface tension, an internal energy. And from the screen point of view, Einstein's laws are essentially fundamental laws of thermodynamics plus a fundamental law for entropy production rate. And the entropy production rate is a Boolean equation that can be interpreted as a Laplace-Young equation for the screen in space. And I think this brings new lights to the nature of gravity, a new point of view on non-equilibrium physics too. Like this dynamical Laplace-Young equation is really at the frontier of non-equilibrium thermodynamics. And the big question is that now we have two different notions of entropy. I have the entropy of the fluid, and I have the entropy of air, you know, of Hawking. So which one is really the one we should talk about? And they both agree near equilibrium, but which one is the right one out of equilibrium? And is there a principle in thermo that determines the evolution of, this is the question for thermodimension. Is there an equation in nature that tells me how I go towards equilibrium? I mean, it seems that we exist, right? So, and we are made of physics element. So there is a law that somehow says, and we are really out of equilibrium. So there's a law somehow that says how complex systems put themselves together. And we know that like Rayleigh-Benard cells is a good example, but you know, there's no general thermal principle. This is really one of the big questions in non-equilibrium thermodynamics. So it's interesting here that there is some similar questions that appears in gravity. And then, okay. More questions? Yeah, thank you.
The equilibrium or quasi-equilibrium system, and apart from equilibrium, you have to add more terms to describe gravity?
No. I'm saying that gravity, as it stands, is exactly equivalent to a non-equilibrium thermodynamical system. Mm-hmm. I'm talking about classical gravity. I don't change one word of classical gravity.
I see.
This is, you can say, I'm just changing the picture. It's just a physical description of the same equation.
Yes, but in gravity, you always associate the entropy to the area. Here you are thinning the...
Well, that's the question. Why do you do that? That's essentially my whole point. Here, I'm very sympathetic to these things. People tell me the entropy is the area. I'm asking the question, okay, is it? And in order to do that, I need to understand the process of entropy production. So this is where I'm going there. And I'm saying that the classical derivations
I strongly disagree with your last remarks here, because in the dynamical horizon case, one allows gravitational waves, it is a totally non-equilibrium situation,
yeah,
in which you can actually, the area actually does increase, with, you know, it's not quasi-static on it. I mean, you can take that approximation, but the fundamental laws do not refer to that, and one does get laws which are the integral versions of the standard first law.
Yeah. So there's two. I agree. There's two things. It doesn't apply to what I said. There's two things here with that, which are first. You know, I'm talking about a physical system, which is time-like, whereas it's space-like. But let's forget about that for a moment. The other thing is that the way you define an horizon is by defining the radial. I mean, you have the radial expansion to vanish. So you're in this context. So if you look at a process that do not change the internal energy of the spring, yes, you conclude that thing. That's, I totally agree. In a general context.
It's not really an expansion.
But it's a different, I think it's a different thing.
I know, but in dynamical, but it does exist in standard literature, a view in which non-equilibrium processes are included, does play the role of area.
Good. But the systems you're talking about are not time-like systems. They are space-like systems. So the evolution you're talking about, right, we can talk maybe about that. I think it's a very important thing. I'm talking about physical system. Dynamic horizon doesn't intersect with my talk here. Okay, I want to talk about the boundary of, it's a very different system. I'm talking about the boundary of a physical system, which evolved. It cannot, by definition, it cannot be a dynamic horizon because it's time-like.
Much of your setup, holographic principle, thermodynamic equations producing gravity in the sense, it's very close to entropic gravity, the Philander setup. Can you comment a little bit on the relations?
It sounds like they're the same word, screens and entropy. I don't know, in some sense for me, I don't know, I should ask him. Here I'm really talking about full gravity. And I've extracted from full gravity this thermodynamical interpretation. Whether it agrees with what he was saying, I don't know. It's really, he's saying it in a Newtonian context. There's no flow, there's no viscosity, there's no concept of entropy production. I don't know. It's but maybe there is the Newtonian limit of that might be related.
Thank you, Ron.
Is it on?
Yes. Our next speaker is Anthony Coutin, and will tell us about lessons from acoustic records.
Okay, thank you very much. Thanks for your calendar to give me this opportunity to present this work. So what I would like to do is present the process of Hawking radiation in acoustic black hole. And I will use this particular context to shed some light on what is called the transplanting question. So this comes from work with my former advisor Ron Parentani and my collaborator Stefano Finazzi and Alessandro Pavi. So you obviously all know what the Hawking process is, but let me just recall what are the main properties of this phenomenon. So if you consider classical and non-dynamical black hole background, and you put a quantum field on it, then this field will spontaneously emit a stationary flux. And this flux has a particular property, it's that it is thermal. So it obeys the Planck law, if you forget about gravity factors. But the temperature is well defined and is given in terms of the surface gravity. So I'd like to emphasize one thing. So this comes in the context, of course, of black hole thermodynamics. But I think it's very interesting to notice that it's not only consistent with the black hole thermodynamics. In fact, it's necessary if you want to have a consistent generalized second law for a couple thermodynamical system in black hole. So this is why the Hawking process is so crucial. But there is several reasons to question this semi-classical picture. And one of them is the fact that if you look at the freely falling frequencies of the photon emitted by a black hole, because of the redshift near the horizon, the very low energetic photon you get at infinity, they actually come from photons with extremely high freely falling frequency near the horizon, so potentially way above the Planck scale. So this might be a problem, because you could wonder, at such high energy, is the semi-classical feature correct and neglect of gravitational quantum interaction? And there were also some work, and I want to quote Toft for this, that he finds some very large contribution when trying to incorporate gravitational interaction into this picture. And this is fully related with this peak of Richard. So on the other hand, you could say that this is just a stupid question, because in Minkowski space, locally, the Hawking effect is just the Unruh effect, and the Unruh effect is in Minkowski space. So there is obviously no translation frequency there and no extremely high interaction. So at this level, it's really a question whether it makes sense. And this is why we could probe this question in a particular context, which is the context of acoustic black hole. Okay? So this was discovered in 81, the fact that there is a mathematical identity between the propagation of perturbation in moving fluid and the propagation of a field around a black hole. So later it was understood that what will start altering the picture due to this high redshift is the fact that in Koenig's magnetic system in fluids, when you go to very short wavelength, at some point you necessarily break the Lorentz invariance. Okay, you won't start, for example, seeing the interatomic scale or any phenomenon will do this. So later, this raises the question, does this dispersive effect could be alter the Hawking process, or will it be maintained? And then since 95, there has been a lot of work, analytical and numerical, to confirm that the Hawking process seems to be maintained even if you break Lorentz invariance in the ultraviolet regime. And now we can see the first actual experiment coming out to detect the Hawking process in some condensed matter systems, so water, voltage, and condensate, in particular the classical analog of the Hawking process 3 years ago in Vancouver. Okay, so let me be a little more precise of what I mean by this analogy. If you consider a moving fluid with a certain velocity, the perturbation will propagate just like on a curve spacetime, and yeah, you can picture this, that if the fluid is going very slow, then waves can go upstream or downstream. But if the fluid is going faster than the speed of the waves, then the waves are trapped inside this high current velocity region. And this is exact, and this hand-waving analogy is actually a mathematical identity. It's really the Klein-Gordon equation in curve space-time. And in particular, if you have this velocity, you want to consider the Klein-Gordon equation is in a specific set of coordinates, which is called the Pavlovian-Schwarzschild coordinates. And the surface gravity of your horizon will exactly be the gradient of the velocity flow on the horizon. Okay. So as I said, if you want to consider Hawking radiation, you will always have to consider the fact that Lorentz invariance is not exact in acoustic black holes. And for this, it means that there is a preferred notion of frequency, and this notion, for long wavelength, you still have omega squared equal p squared, but then when you start going at short wavelength, you start feeling a deviation from this. And this will be characterized by some energy scale or length scale that I call lambda here. So in condensed matter system, lambda would be given by the physics of the fluid you're considering. But you could argue that in astrophysics, it could be some phenomenological effect from Planckian physics. Okay, so that's the spirit. The spirit is what I want to consider is not to detail how this comes about. It's more to consider it and see what are the implications for Hawking process. So the motivation are in astrophysics. You can see it as a sign, an effective description of transplanted physics. So it would be the idea of theories like Einstein ether or Haarer-Lipschitz, where you assume Lorentz invariance breaking. In analog gravity, then it's just not an assumption, it's what it is. And also, I think it's worth the line that it also helps understanding the Lorentz invariance case better, because we now, if you understand how it works when you violate it, you see how crucial it is for the Hawking process or not. So how do you solve, how do you have the Hawking process comes about in acoustic black holes? So you consider this modified, the Klein-Gordon equation with higher derivative term, which are the modified dispersion relation, and you found out that there is several solutions of the mod equation, and there is particular two modes which are incoming in the sense they are going toward the horizon. They're very high momentum, typically of the order of the dispersive scale. And there is also the two outgoing, going away from the horizon, which are the relativistic solution. It's actually the Hawking particle and its partner. And there is also the solution of the wave equation, which just crosses regularly, falls in the horizon, and which is not interesting for the Hawking process. It's unrelated. And the fact that there is these two different solution living and mixing, we start saying that these two solutions of the wave equation, what's very important is that they have opposite norm, okay? So because near the horizon, we have a mixing between this mode, and this mixing mix the different modes of different signs of norm. So this is called an anomalous scattering. And this means that in the second quantized picture, you will mix creation and annihilation operator. And therefore, the incoming vacuum will be populated. Okay. So I want to stress that this is exactly the Hawking process in another context. It is, that is, the spontaneous emission of a stationary flux from the horizon because of this anomalous scattering. And now the only question which is left is, what is the spectrum? Does it still look like a Planck spectrum when you have this dispersion? So this was answered, several years ago, but we were attached to understand more precisely under which condition this is realized. Okay? So the method, very quickly, we approximate the near horizon geometry by the Sitter space, which comes very naturally in this set of coordinates. And there, you can use Fourier transform, and you have a very good control of the solution of the wave equation. So what do we find? We find that this mixing of positive and negative norm modes occur on a finite-sized region near the horizon, okay, the broadening length. And this length is given by a combination between the surface gravity and the dispersive length. Okay? And now, the precise condition to recover Hawking radiation is that you want the gradient of the velocity fluid, that is the surface gravity, to be approximately constant on a region that is larger than this broadening length. Okay? Because it's on this region where the mixing occurs. And I can also tell you that if you have very small details of the background that are smaller than this length, then it will just basically not be seen by the modes, and they will barely affect the Hawking process. So the idea here is that once you introduce dispersion, the new way of thinking about the horizon is about a thick region of space, and no longer of just a precise locus. And this thickness would be given by this length. In particular, there were this debate on how you define the notion of horizon in a dispersive theory, because you use the relativistic definition, or you should use the group velocity of the modes, for example, which can change depending on the frequency. And the lesson here is that those two notions are, in fact, indistinguishable in the sense that they precisely lie within the region of this size when the Hawking process is recovered. Okay? So this is the fact that the horizon should be interpreted as broadened. Okay, so let me skip this slide. I would like to now to use the rest of my time to present a different phenomenon that occurs when you add dispersion, and which is an instability which occurs when you consider black holes that now have also an inner horizon, and also if the dispersion is superluminal. So that means that the dispersive effect tends to increase the speed. The modes. In that case, the Hawking partner, when it's emitted from the horizon, is blue shifted near the inner horizon, and then it's converted into an incoming high momentum mode, which will go back to the black hole horizon and stimulate more Hawking emission. So what you have is that you have an exponentially growing flux of Hawking quanta, and this creates an instability of this kind of black hole. So mathematically, this translates it. You can solve the problem by looking at the complex frequencies of the mode equation, and the instable mode have a positive imaginary part, that is a growing in time behavior. Okay. So we developed a technique to compute fully this spectrum when you have
a large black hole and that the instability is not too big. So we find basically that very close to what happens in resonant physics, in quantum mechanics, you have a Bohr-Sommerfeld condition for the real part of the frequency and a formula for the growing rate, which is given by, so this coefficient would be the amount of particle protected by one horizon for the usual Hawking process. And therefore, and this is the classical time to make a trip between the two horizons. So this corresponds to the semi-classical feature. So what happens in practice if you turn on this thing is that for very short time, you basically do see the exponential is still linear. And what you see is exactly the steady flux of Hawking radiation, which is just as before. But then when the mode inside start making several round trip, you see an exponential growth and also the discreteness of the spectrum will occur. Okay, and what one thing is which is very interesting in this process is the fact that if you push this energy scale where Lorentz invariance is broken to infinity, in fact, this growing rate is going to zero, but as the inverse of a log, which means basically extremely slowly. So it means that the limit of the relativistic limit is almost singular, because even if this is Planck scale and you take an astrophysical black hole, this would create an instability that is seen for a very short scale, like for the order of the second. So it's really almost singular in that sense. And okay, so let me finish by this. So the lesson here is that the Hawking process, which is an energetic instability, is turned on into a dynamical instability if you feed back the locus of the Hawking process by its own radiation, okay? And now, so I presented one example where this occurs, okay? Because, so what you need is to convert the Hawking partner into the incoming UV modes, okay? And for this, you want to make a large momentum transfer. So in my example, the inner horizon, the blue shift, we're doing this for you. But now if you consider another different black hole, you could ask near the singularity, well, the gradient, the spatial gradients become very high. This could be enough to create some mode mixing that will bounce back this mode. So what I mean by this picture is that I presented one possibility, but in any case where you have a violation of Lorentz invariance, you want to reconsider the question of black hole stability, because this could be drastically affected by the modified dispersion relation. Okay? So the main result I presented here was the fact that to properly think about dispersion, you want to consider horizon as broadened horizon of finite size. And also that now you want to reconsider this notion of stability. Okay, so and let me keep on perspective.
Thank you. Questions?
Given that issue, I'm just restudying all this stuff. I'm just wondering, you assume that the energy as seen by, as measured by a free-falling observer would be interesting for characterizing the transplantian problem. But once you allow for Lorentz imagery to be valid, is it obvious what, you know, how it depends on even if you have a good control of how it depends on energy as measured by asymptotic observers, how are you sure how the dependence gets mapped into the energy for the free falling? So that, I mean, if you have no violation, no tangible effects of the violation for the asymptotic form, which sees low energy, photon, why do you? You know, is it automatically an opinion that then the free-falling observer effect is good? You are assuming.
No, I'm not. I don't think I said that for free-falling observer the effect will be big. Probably will stay reasonably small, but it changes the picture because now the free-falling frequency is really. Once you have Lorentz invariance, you can always say, "Oh, frequency, you can boost it and make it small again." But then, here I have a preferred notion of frequency, which is a physical one. So the question is reconsidered. But then the translation question is changed because So I was very fast on this. But instead of having an infinite focusing near the horizon, when you go back in time, then the modes go toward the horizon, and then they're swept away. So the redshift just lasts for a finite amount of time. So the redshift is high. It converts basically low energy modes to these modes of order of this new energy scale. But it's finite and when controlled. So the question is completely turned in a different way. And I said, well, I would say the question is well posed now, if you break Lorentz invariants. And actually, it's the lesson here is that it's partially resolved. It's resolved in the sense that the redshift is finite, the Hawking process is robust, but in some configuration, it could have drastic effect, like the instability, which is this answer.
Okay, thank you very much.
Hello, thanks everybody. I'd like to thank the organizers for inviting me to give the time to talk about my work. It's work done in collaboration with the Relativistic Quantum Information Group in the University of Nottingham in the UK. I'm just going to introduce a framework we've been developing over the last couple of years to ask quantum information questions within quantum field theory on the curved spacetime. I'll be working in purely flat spacetime today, but it can be extended to curved spacetime. So I'd just like to start off with a little summary of what we're going to be talking about in the today. Just a little introduction, a motivation, why a quantum information guy wants to stick his big nose into quantum gravity, ask questions about this kind of stuff. Then we'll move on to the framework, what we've been developing. In particular, I'll introduce the bits of quantum field theory that we'll need to know. Something called Bogoliubov transformations about relating different observers. The Gaussian state stuff is the quantum information that you'll get subject to today, so apologies for that if you don't like quantum information. But, it's very nice mathematical, and the whole point of the business is that we're going to talk about motion of the cavities through space-time. Then I'll get onto a concrete example of a quantum information question, which is called quantum teleportation, which is basically a way of transferring quantum information from one person to another, and I'll tell you about our angle, and then if there's time, a little bit of a recap and some future directions of what we're doing. So motivation. So I'm interested in knowing how information is stored, processed, and can be used for communications. This is a very important thing these days in terms of satellites and telecommunications. In particular, there's becoming a very large push on communications in space using quantum information. And we're interested in knowing if there's anything to do with quantum field theory and curved space-time and gravitational physics that could affect the storage and manipulation and processing of quantum information. So that's roughly why we're going to do it. And RQI, acronym, Relativistic Quantum Information, is at the minute an attempt to fuse quantum information and quantum field theory together. It can be a lot more general than that. This is just the early days. I mean, it's a very early, very, very young field, but that's what I'll be looking at. And I suppose the main objective of RQI is to try and come up with something that can't be possible without quantum field theory and quantum information. So is there something that when you put them together exists when it can't be possible on its own? So that's one of the big objectives. So. But anyway, let's get straight into the framework. So today we're talking about quantum field theory in flat space time, but I'll write the general 1+1 Klein-Gordon scalar field equation in terms of some coordinates. So the whole point is that we're going to have two different types of observer, an inertial observer and an accelerated observer. And I'm going to relate these two guys by Bogoliubov transformations and describe the motion of cavities, what we call cavities through space-time, because that's what we're interested in. Interestingly enough, I'm completely on the same page as the first speaker who wanted to know about things in a finite region instead of being spread out all over infinity. We're very much interested in cavities that are localized to some region in space-time, so experimentally verifiable predictions here, you know, using cavities that you'll go to a guy in the lab and say, can you prepare this state for me in the cavity? And normally they'll be able to tell you yes. But moving on, sorry. So we have the scalar field, 1+1 dimensions, just as an example. We pick some coordinates, say the Minkowski coordinates, and we do the standard second quantization, canonical quantization, where we promote the field solutions to operators and impose usual commutation relations. And we normalize the modes with the inner product on the solution space. And notice that I've got summations here and not integrals over the momentum. This is because of what I was saying, that we're using cavities. So we're imposing boundary conditions. So the field's vanishing on one side of the wall and on the other side of the wall, which discretizes the spectrum. And this, again, is this localization thing that we're interested in. We wanted to know about a field stored in a cavity, and we want to see what happens if we move this cavity and what happens to the information stored inside it. So I've just said that these modes here, so these UK you can associate with, say, an inertial observer, so someone who's stationary, who just describes the field in his natural mode. What happens if we've got a different observer, say an accelerated observer, and he wants to describe the modes in terms of the field in terms of his modes, which is a perfectly reasonable question to ask. So we've got some different set of modes. How can we relate these, the field written in terms of the UKs and the VKs? Well, the standard trick in quantum field theory, when you'd rather do this with some conditions, of course, is that you expand the field in terms of both these solution sets. It's the same quantized field, it's just expanded in different modes. You write a relation between the one set of modes and the other in terms of a superposition of both of UKs and UBARKs, so these are just complex conjugates in terms of what are these alpha Ks and beta K, alpha KK primes and beta KK primes, which are what are known as Bogoliubov coefficients. So it's just basically a change of basis in the same way that you would in a linear algebra. And using the inner product of the modes, you can work out what these alphas and betas are. And these are the Bogoliubov coefficients, and this is how you relate one observer to another. And this is what we're going to be using throughout the entire talk to model how a cavity moves through space-time. Just as a side note, well, not as a side note, but as a very interesting fact is that these Bogoliubov coefficients can actually be put together in a matrix S, which satisfy, and the matrices alpha and beta, the matrices formed of the coefficients that I defined on the previous slide. And this matrix S happens to satisfy the symplectic group definition, or asymplectic group definition. That might not be the usual one that you see, but it is still the real symplectic group. It's just in a complex representation. And this is very useful. And the reason is that what is the link to quantum information here? So I've been talking about quantum field theory and changing from one observer to another observer, but where's the quantum information here? Well, it turns out that we can use these symplectic matrices in a very useful way in quantum information. And this is where we get onto something called Gaussian state quantum information, which is a small subset of quantum information, but it's very, very useful for our purposes. So I'll just start off with saying, let's define a vector of mode operators, and you just stack the mode, the annihilation and creation operators in the vector here. A Gaussian state is a state which is completely characterized by what are called its first and second moments. Its first moments are just the expectation values of each individual component of the vector here. So it's just the trace of the operator with the state that you're interested in, and defined by this gamma matrix here, whose components are just the expectation values of the commutator of these two quantities, which is basically just the mode operator you're interested in. So these are the components minus its expectation value. This forms a vector, this forms a matrix, and this is all you need to know to describe what's called a Gaussian state in quantum information. And this is very useful because not only has it got a great mathematical description, which we'll get into. It's underpinned by a lot of symplectic geometry, but it's actually experimentally very accessible. So like I keep saying, oh, hello.
Rho is a density matrix here or
something? Yeah, rho's a density matrix, just the state of your field. Yeah, that's right. Sorry about that. Yeah, these are all on a Hilbert space, and these are just vectors and matrices in a phase space, represent phase space state. And like I was saying, that we're going for experimental observation here. So, and this is very useful. And like I said, Gaussian states are very accessible experimentally. Quantum opticians love it when you say, like, can you prepare, can they use a Gaussian state? Because this is basically all that they can do in the lab very easily. But obviously, the Bogoliubov transformations that I defined for you before were on a Hilbert space. So, and they are a unitary transformation, which means that they preserve the canonical commutation relations of the field and the field operators. So how does this translate to the Gaussian state stuff? How to this covariance matrix and this first moments? Well, it turns out that any unitary transformation that's Gaussian preserving can be represented as this transformation, where this S is exactly the Bogoliubov transformation that we defined earlier. So as long as this unitary isn't too crazy and doing too many strange things, if you start with a Gaussian state rho and you have a Gaussian preserving unitary, its transformation can be completely characterized by these simple transformation laws. And this is all now in matrices. Instead of working on a Hilbert space, and this becomes actually very, very nice because you hit it with all, you know, the classical theorems of symplectic geometry and diagonalizing positive definite matrices like gamma and things. So anyway, but just as a quick example, this is how a set of first moments and a covariance matrix might look. And as a good example, the vacuum state actually has zero first moments, and its covariance matrix is just the identity. So it's represented very, very simply. So let's continue with the framework. So like I said before, we're wanting to represent a cavity moving through space-time as a symplectic transformation, so going from one observer to another. We do this by decomposing a general trajectory, so our symplectic matrix S represents a general transformation, a general trajectory. We decompose it into many little trajectories, so it could be one accelerator, inertial accelerators, stuff like this. And they're all characterized by an acceleration and a time. So we're interested in acceleration and inertial. We can further decompose these matrices into basically a transformation that takes us from, if you can see that, a transformation that takes us from one type of observer, so say inertial to accelerated. We evolve for some time in that frame, and then we transform back again into the previous frame. So this is how we're going to model our motion of our cavity. So we take a state in the cavity, we change it to a different frame, let time, well, I'll go to the next slide. So we can envisage this as so. So say we start as an inertial observer, so here's the cavity walls. We transform we Bogoliubov transform into the accelerated frame. We time evolve for some initial time under unitary transformation in there, it's just a free Hamiltonian. Then we Bogoliubov transform back again, and as you can see, this was where the cavity was. Each wall accelerates, and then you can kind of just see here that the cavity walls now have some finite velocity as because they've accelerated. And this is how we're going to model our motion. And you can stack these things up, so you can have different types of motion, and you can glue them all together and have a cavity move in any way you want using Bogoliubov transformations. But now I'll just quickly, briefly go through what quantum teleportation is. So like I said before, it's a way of taking quantum information from one observer to another observer. And this is represented by what's called a quantum channel E. And you can imagine this quite simply by two observers, Alice and Bob. They share some entangled state, and they want to use this entangled state to transfer a completely unknown state from, say, Alice to Bob. I won't say the details, but there's a well-known way of doing this. And basically, Bob can go and fly off, and he's somewhere else. And Alice then does some procedure, and then sends some classical information to Bob, and then he can do some operation on his state. And hopefully, the unknown state that was with Alice has now been transferred to Bob. But this normally doesn't take into account the actual motion of Bob. So this is the standard textbook treatment. Doesn't care if Bob's moved or not. And this is where we change everything. This is where we start representing. So we transform Bob's state with respect to these symplectic transformations, and this changes the channel, and therefore the state that Bob gets out at the end. And this is basically teleportation in a nutshell. And the way that we characterize how well the teleportation's been done is by what's something called the fidelity, which basically means if the state you wanted to transfer is transferred at 100% accurately, you get fidelity 1. If your state has been transferred and it's got completely jumbled and it's nothing to do with the state that you wanted it to be, fidelity is 0. So we basically go up between 0 and 1. And I'll just quickly throw up the result and then we'll conclude. So the result is that when we compute this fidelity for a scenario where Bob just accelerates for some time for once and accelerates just once, we can write this H parameter. We do a perturbative calculation and see that F naught is the fidelity if Bob hadn't have moved, so that's, you know, all the optimum fidelity if he hadn't accelerated, minus some, this is a positive contribution, so you see that the acceleration has affected the ability you can transfer this information, which, like I said before, is important for us because we want to know how well we can transfer quantum information in when things are moving. And it's dependent on H and tau and to the Bogoliubov coefficients, of course. Reiterate that the acceleration has affected our ability to transfer. Hello, yes.
The F2, you showed the dependence, but
So I reckon F2 will be zero.
Yeah.
Yeah, sure, you can fiddle around. Oh, hang on, there's a typo there. That 8 shouldn't be there because it's in there. So this is a bit of a calculation. Yeah, so if depending on the field, if you've got a massless field and then you wait for some appropriate time and you've set up your situation correctly, then yes, you can recover the optimum fidelity. But anyway, I'll continue because I think I'm running out of time. Here's it. And then, like I was saying, so this has implications for the transfer of information. We'll just quickly wrap up. So what have we seen? We've seen a framework where we can concretely set up quantum field theory problems using these Bogoliubov transformations to describe cavity movement. Or it doesn't need to be cavities either, or even the scalar field. As long as you've got the correct commutation relations and inner product structure, you can describe all these things in terms of symplectic geometry and the Gaussian states. We analyzed teleportation just as an example of something in a quantum information theorist is interested in, and it has implications on for us anyway that are interested in the information really does care about how it's transmitted. You know, if it's contained within a box and that box is moved, or even if the field just goes through a gravitational field via the equivalence principle, the information will be changed. And these are based on some papers, and I'll just put some future directions that we could. I put thanks first. Thank you for listening, and then I'll go back again to possible future directions. Yes.
Can you say something about the strength of correlations? You know, when people entangle things,
yep.
They have the Bell bound, and there's this quantum bound,
yep.
Zero sum bound. Is there something happening with the strength of correlations?
So I left this out purposefully, but it's all built into this teleportation procedure, right? So Alice and Bob come together, and they have two separate cavities. And they come together, they prepare some entangled state, which you quite rightly said has some entanglement. You know, it's got some bound, depending on what kind of system you've got, whether it's maximally entangled or not. But they have some entanglement. This is their resource. And then Bob flies away and takes his piece of this entangled state with him. And that can never increase them. So once they've created it, now he disappears. Unless they do some kind of crazy superluminal signaling and they're changing everything in their boxes, they can't change entanglement. So the only thing that can happen is this thing that we see, that it can either stay the same, which means that the fidelity stays the same, the entanglement stays the same, or it goes down. So it is all in there, but you just need to know all the details, and that's where I chucked it all into that capital E transformation, just to hocus pocus you. But, you know.
Transformations model unitary
evolution,
yes. Is common in semi-classical physics. I was wondering if you could comment on the relationship between that and this approach.
Sure. They have the same roots, really. So the Gaussian states that you defined are basically a rip-off of classical Gaussian states. You know, so the reason where they come about is that. The way that you define it, a quantum state can be represented by its Wigner distribution or its characteristic function, right? It just turns out that once you define the Wigner distribution, when you act on it with a specific type of unitary transformation, and it has to be a specific type, it has to be what I said, this Gaussian preserving, you can't have any old unitary there. But once you have ones that satisfy the certain conditions, turns out that the way that the first and second moments are transformed are exactly in this way that I said, and it just happens to be the symplectic transformation. So they have got, you know, very similar roots, and so they're intertwined in that way.
I mean, I know it's not very well some question, but you assume entanglement can only be produced locally, and then you have to move on.
Yes.
That's a standard assumption, of course.
Yes.
Have you ever thought about maybe producing entanglement for observers that are actually apart already?
Sure. So there's a lot of the early work in the field of relativistic quantum information looked at this kind of thing and asked about if two people are space-like separated, can they become entangled? And yes, they can, because in the situation that they considered, basically they had two detectors that were really far apart from each other, and then they interact with the vacuum of the field, which is, you know, globally well defined, and then it, after some time, the correlations start to propagate. So the people have looked at that for our situation. No, not really, because we're thinking about things that can be done in terms of labs and stuff. We're just, everything's going to be in the cavity anyway, so it doesn't matter if you make entanglement between these two guys, because it's all, but I don't know, no, myself not particularly, but I know people have looked at space-like entanglement, and also time-like. You can correlate things in past and future, like a memory. Yeah. But,
okay,
so thanks.
Thank you.
Hi, well, I'd like, certainly like to thank the organizers for inviting me to come and give this talk. So I point out I am from a QCD group, not from a classical and quantum gravity group. So any gaps that I make, I'm here to be educated and very eager to learn more. So this work was about dynamical instability of sort of the next more complicated volume of space. We were motivated by, you know, kind of black hole thermodynamic processes and what at the microscopic level might drive equilibration of black holes. And we know, everyone knows that unitarity basically means that information is going to be conserved in a quantum system. So it's not easy to think about where entropy growth comes from, and at least in not a trivial way. The usual explanation for entropy growth in quantum systems is some aspect of coarse graining. Basically, you end up making your system so complicated, it's driven by such perhaps classical underlying complicated dynamics in the quantum version, that you basically, you smear the phase space around so much that when you make a measurement, you don't have enough resolution. There's sort of a get out, but you can always argue you don't have enough resolution to completely resolve the state. So you're always gonna have apparent thermal properties unless you had a detector that was perhaps magically not limited by the Heisenberg principle. Then perhaps you could see past this problem. So sort of that's the sort of background motivation for why it might be interesting to look at just, you know, fundamental building blocks of a quantum description of space. If we just take an intertwiner or its sort of classical equivalent, which is a polyhedron, can we learn something about how sort of larger theories of gravity might actually give thermalization in terms of the classical dynamics of a small system? Because if there's some aspect of chaos there or thermalization is clear there, then you sort of hope that it will keep passing upwards as you make the theory more complicated. So there's been a lot of recent work into the volume spectrum of the semi-classical tetrahedron, which we sort of think about it, you know, as a hydrogen atom of space. This is classically, the tetrahedron, a completely integrable system. The integrability of it lets you sort of actually completely quantize it, and you can understand the quantum volume spectrum back from the classical version, and agrees very nicely with the sort of volume operator spectra that you'd expect just from the pure quantum side theory. And so this pentahedron, the next slightly more complicated system, we don't really expect it to have trivial dynamics. This is much more a sort of helium atom system. You now have an extra degree of freedom. Classically, as I'll show you, the dynamics are really complicated. And if you were to somehow be able to quantize this classical system, I think you might find some slightly surprising results. So just to sort of give you a picture again about what I mean by coarse-grained entropy and how that leads to thermalization, you have this classic idea of the standard map, which is a sort of the evolution of a complicated Hamiltonian system where you just look at its evolution in the Poincaré surface of section. And if you sort of start an initial condition all in one part of its phase space, as time goes on, it will all get smeared out and, you know, become kind of unentanglable. You can't really tell which of these dots corresponds to these initial conditions. So in some sense, you've thermalized, you've forgotten your initial state, you don't know where you are. And you can show that the entropy grows linearly and that the slope, the rate of entropy growth, is actually proportional to the Aplanov exponents. So this really just makes this connection that chaosness or non-integrability, the Aplanov exponents, are directly connected to an entropy growth rate in this kind of system. So that's just some background. What do I mean? What are we going to be talking about? We're going to be talking about these Minkowski polyhedra, which we can basically define. This theorem of Minkowski basically shows that you can uniquely define a polyhedron in terms of a collection of vectors that represent each face. So you have some kind of scale associated with that vector, which is the area of the face, and the direction, which is the normal to that face. If you're used to thinking about geometric problems, you don't usually represent polygons in the polyhedra in this way. You usually represent them in much more easy ways, like their vertices and stuff. So this is actually quite interesting, because it's very, very different from at least computational geometry would pick other ways of doing this. It turns out that Kapovich and Milson, some clever applied mathematicians, figured out a phase space for the set of polyhedra with F faces, and this allows us to actually give a sort of classical Hamiltonian dynamics to the polyhedra, and I'll explain how that works. And we can sort of consider this space of deformation of polyhedra as a sort of classical limit of SU2 intertwiners which have F legs. If you have F faces, there's a pretty neat duality, and Eugenio's worked all this out along with other people. So what's this phase space look like? Well, we have action angle variables on them, where basically you have a momentum. If we think about the easiest way to think about it is to take your polyhedron and just draw this kind of polygon where we've connected together each of our vectors. The vectors of the direction, again, is the normal, and its length is the area of the face. So then you can represent the system in terms of a polygon that's not flat, it's crumpled. So you have something like maybe a benzene ring to kind of imagine. And this polygon then lets you nicely think about what these momenta and angles mean. The momenta is exactly these dihedral lengths. So the longer these lengths are, the more sort of polygon you've got. And that turns out to be sort of carry through to the total volume of the system, which is what we're interested in. And then you have these angles, which are to do with the sort of angles between the adjacent planes. It turns out that Kapovich and Milson basically come up with these because they have a sort of free particle flow in their initial paper, where they basically just, let's say, have a Hamiltonian that's just proportional to the momentum, and then these are exactly action angle coordinates. The polygon, each of these leaves kind of whips around and rotates around the momenta. The flow under a different Hamiltonian, we're going to use the volume, is not going to be as simple as that. So again, just to recap what was done with the tetrahedral case, is that you can work out the volume of a tetrahedron in terms of the face areas is exactly, well, this is the volume squared. And so you get these kind of nice orbits in the phase space of P and Q, which looks like there's lots of nice conserved quantities there, and you can quantize it, and you get, you know, very good agreement with the sort of the above area kind of quantum tetrahedron volume result. So this is, really nice. And so if you actually, the details of this is that I think the open circles are the theory predictions from this side, and the dots are the predictions that you get from going back to classical and then quantizing again. So the pentahedron is a bit more difficult. The pentahedron now is going to have 2 degrees of freedom. We have 2 momenta. There's 2 of these dihedral lengths, and then there are 2 angles which you are going to be bending around. We sort of have an intuition from classical mechanics that anything with 2 degrees of freedom is not integrable unless you conspire and make a very nice system, or you've got something very simple. And so it's a good question is then, is this evolution going to be chaotic? What we do is we proceed to solve for the volume numerically using this method by Lasserre, where you sort of rebuild from any particular configuration of P and Q. You can actually go back through this process of putting together what the pentahedron would look like, and then you do some sort of computing stuff to figure out what the volume of that pentahedron was. Hal Haggard, being a smart man, actually solved this analytically, and so was able to treat some other aspects of the problem. A part of this, there is a huge numerical burden here, so unfortunately we had to fix all the face areas to actually get anything done. So we fixed the face areas to 1. This is something that needs to be investigated, because this may actually impose some rather unnatural constraints on the phase space.
So is this just a classical volume, the flat space that you're calculating, or is
yes.
it the volume?
Yes, it's literally how much water could you pour inside this pentahedron. So here's just some representative sections through the volume, which we're going to think of now as a Hamiltonian. A sort of rule of thumb is that with equal areas, the volume of a triangular prism with equilateral triangular faces, and that if you make the face areas fixed to 1, there's only 1 of those, has a volume of 0.658. And that turns out to be almost the maximum volume of the system that we get when we explore this numerically. So cool colors mean low volume. Yellowy warm colors mean higher volumes. This section here is through the momentum space. This is P1, this is P2. There are these constraints. You can't have certain values because you basically pull the that polygon representation, you'll pull it apart if you go into these regions. In the angle space, it's periodic. You get these kind of regions of high volume around a central low volume region. You can't make it simply in terms of tetrahedral subunits, and you can't just say I have one, two, three tetrahedra added together. The way that how Haggard figures out the actual volume is that you have to extend it into a big enough system that looks like a tetrahedron again by growing the faces, and then work out the difference in volume between that and a smaller truncated one. So all you need to know here is that it's not easy to express this in terms of a linear combination of subunits. It's a nonlinear combination of them that gives you the true volume. So we don't deal with this, we just deal with it numerically, but that's complicated. Again, if we actually, we can look further through the phase space because I like making these big pictures. So now what we're looking at is this, each of these subplots is again in the P space and here in the Q space, but now we spray them out across the Q space or across the P space. So basically what you can draw from this is that if you look globally at smaller momenta, then regardless of Q, you tend to have smaller volumes here. These volumes are low. And at the larger momenta where both of them are almost maximized, most of the available phase space has high volume. This turns out just to give you some idea of where the high volume and low volume dynamics are. And there's no obvious integrals. You can play around this for a long time, transforming it, trying to find something that might be preserved. But there's nothing obviously preserved. So there's no clear hope of even separating the Hamiltonian into a P squared part and some other part. It doesn't work. So this actually makes it very interesting because then you don't really have anything to use as a small scale to do a perturbation around if it's not really separable at all. So what's the dynamics like? Well, we have this idea that we're basically rotating these fixed length vectors around each other, and we are always trying to maintain a constant volume. And what does that look like? Well, floppy. We have two, this is the sort of almost maximum volume case. You can see this one, this is going through, I think it goes through a couple of periods, it loops. This is quite stable. The phase areas are not changing, but you can see what's happening that is that because the phase areas are being fixed, everything else has to wobble around to compensate and to keep the volume fixed. In this case, the smaller volume one, see if I can make it play again, it's a bit more unstable. It actually flips between, even though this is a smooth trajectory in the phase space, you can see that it flips between a few different looking polyhedra to give you this consistent evolution. If we go to smaller and smaller volumes, then it's just harder and harder to actually run an integrator for long enough to make one consistent animation, which is why we only have these two. I hope to fix that. So one of the things that comes about when you start thinking about all this is this idea of configurations of the system. You have two preferred faces, which are the triangular ones that are different fundamentally from the square ones. And because we always know we can number each of our normals and we can always identify them numerically, we can basically build up this idea of there's different configurations in terms of which of the faces did we number as the triangles each time we rebuild the system. So different locations in phase space correspond to different configurations. Some transitions between configurations are allowed. You make these kind of smooth squashes so that you turn it from these one and three being the triangular faces to two and four, and some of them aren't. And the configuration boundaries play an important role in the dynamics. So this is another nice plot here. The link nodes show allowed transitions between the colors. We've cut up a slice in the QQ plane. You get this nice sort of roseate structure here, just to point out. So you do see some interfaces which are not allowed transitions. There are forbidden transitions, and then these ones are allowed. This, again, further restricts the dynamics, which is already restricted because it's Hamiltonian. You have this volume-preserving flow. So this makes the dynamics really, really complicated. And if we want to look again across the whole space, you can see there's all this beautiful structure here. So turns out, when you can't solve something, try it a different way. What we thought about doing is that we basically look at the Jacobian of the Hamiltonian locally at points in the position in the phase space. This is sort of solve the linearized equations of motion at that point. And you can take the eigenvalues of that. Converging or stable trajectories will have negative eigenvalues. These are trajectories which at that point are sort of coming together. Diverging ones have positive eigenvalues. It's important to note but it's not a surefire indication of stability. These are what we call local Lyapunov exponents. There's nothing really to stop if you have a region which is a lot of diverging in the trajectories. You can always conspire to reconverge them again somewhere else and have a very complicated but essentially stable periodic or quasi-periodic orbit. So you have to be careful. This is the x squared, y squared system is a good example of this. If you just work this out, it's all where, it seems to be everywhere locally unstable, but everyone was surprised to find that there are these actually very complicated periodic orbits. So if we look through the system, you can still see this roseate structure is here again, and we have these blue points which are locally stable, and then around the interfaces you can see these hot colors mean it's very unstable. And when I talk about stability, we just look at the largest real component positive eigenvalue, just the most unstable thing. And we can, again, cut this up across the space, and you see, again, that there are big regions of stability and instability in the momentum space. It turns out that in the higher volume region, there's more stability than in the low volume region. And we can, again, just to draw the two next to each other, we see that the configurations, the adjacency, is definitely correlated with stability. And you can also histogram the volumes against the stability, and you see that the red dash curve is all the stable points, and they're clustered at high volumes, which are more regular configurations of the polygon, and the other ones are unstable. A nice way to really quantify this is just to compute the microcanonical Kolmogorov Sinai entropy. And we can compute that for the pentahedron and for the Hennell-Hales system, just to compare the two. And the thing that you see when you really, this really concretely shows that at high energies, the entropy is very small and vanishes. The system is essentially stable and integral at very high energies. And at low energies, it's very unstable. This is unlike most classical sort of P squared plus a potential systems, which become unstable at large energies because you start to explore the regions which are very interesting in the potential. You come out of the bound state in Hennell-Hales. The thing you could think about here is basically a spinning top. The more angular momentum, the more energy you give the spinning top, the harder it is for you to push it over with your finger because it likes to stay upright. So at large volumes, the system is stable in that sense. We can compute Lyapunov exponents in the usual way of looking for diverging trajectories, and we do try and do this. It's really hard to numerically integrate the system. We have to use a symplectic implicit Runge-Kutta method to make this work. And we do get Lyapunov exponents. These are not the true Lyapunov exponents because this is not asymptotic time. This is some short time experience, but you basically get this system which at large volumes, the blue curve, is pretty much very stable. This Lyapunov exponent is very small and might decay to zero in the asymptotic limit. And then at small volumes, 0.35, the black curve, it probably is going to stay stable forever. And the dashed lines are our estimates from using the local stability estimates. So you can see that we actually get pretty good agreement between the local stability and the actual dynamical stability. So small volumes of the n equals 5 classical pentahedron are very unstable. They're basically very chaotic. This volume flow is, I think it's fair to say, almost surely actually chaotic. The small configurations are the least stable. These configuration boundaries are linked with the stability of trajectories. As we move to larger systems, for instance, the n equals 6 system, then there are many more actual configurations of polyhedra, as well as configurations of labeling of the faces, which is really going to, you know, make this system only worse. Larger, more complicated polyhedra, presumably larger and more complicated intertwiners, are going to have more complicated structures here. This motion is, it's not ballistic at low energies. It's rapid energy independent diffusion amongst many degrees of freedom. So I think the conclusion is that we would expect generically higher order polyhedra will be more unstable. And it's interesting to think about, well, what does this chaos in the classical side, what does that really carry through to in terms of the spectrum of the volume operator on the quantum side, right? Do we expect to see, as you would in other quantum versions of classically chaotic systems, sort of these level statistics, which are level repulsion and correlation between energy levels, spectral rigidity, which give you this kind of distribution for the level spacings where they're very pushed away from each other and you tend to see separation from the energy levels? Or is that not going to work out? So those are the sort of conclusions. And the next things that would be really fun to do is to actually seriously map the phase space. You know, everyone who does Hamiltonian systems loves Poincaré sections, and it would be beautiful to actually compute some of those for these systems. It would be interesting to explore coupled classical polyhedra, glue them together, put different amounts of sort of ansatzes on how you glue them together, what kind of connection you want to put between them. And it's interesting to think about a periodic table of geometry. We can either increase n, we make the different atoms of space as we make them larger, but we can also imagine this other idea, which is a sort of organic chemistry of geometry, which is where we take small atoms of space and we glue them together with different ways of sort of coupling the tetrahedra together. And that's certainly two different classical roads to go down if you want to explore sort of the volume spectrum at least. Thanks.
I know you are not from this community, but I'm confused. This is a quantum gravity conference. Maybe two of you together can tell me. So what am I learning about quantum gravity from this?
Well, you're maybe learning that I think once you could, if you could really quantize this, re-quantize this system, I think you would then be learning something interesting about the volume spectrum of the n equals 5 instantaneous, if we could re-quantize this system. But you're already learning that what worked for the tetrahedral case and that pushed back into the quantum system is not necessarily going to work here. So the volume, the sort of expectations for the volume being the sum of parabolic pipeds is going to be in the quantum side is very different from the true classical volume, which I think everyone knew anyway, in some sense. But this really shows you that it's very different. And if you look at what that means at the classical side, you get a very different behavior.
So we're learning something about this mapping between this, you know, mathematical classical side and quantum output. But from quantum gravity point of view, I would like to know more about quantum output. So I think from the tetrahedron, because of your work, we learned about degeneracy, right? That efficient way of calculating the degeneracies of eigenvalues. But I could understand here, one is learning that, because you have this question mark about the chaotic behavior, what it means, and so on. So,
probably an interesting point is the picture you were showing in the end. It is when you go to ion valency, instead of asking about the exact spectrum, you can start asking about the statistical properties of the eigenvalues, a similar way as the Luna.
Right, but the last thing is still a question mark, right? In other words, we don't know. I mean, so then I have to do the real calculation for the exact eigenvalues and then compare it with this and see that it is a pattern or not. I cannot conclude anything from the statistical properties directly. Is that ever correct about this? In other words, looking at this graph, and I'll say, oh, that this must be the statistical properties. But that may be completely wrong with the actual volume operator or not.
I think it would be very strong evidence. Yeah. It would be surprising if it's not the case. I really much check and understanding from both sides. But if it's not the case, it would be again interesting because it would be something really unexpected.
Yeah, I would have stated it much more strongly than Chris did. If it's classically chaotic, it would be shocking if it didn't have this spectral statistic. There's very strong, almost at the level of theorems, that if it's classically chaotic, it has this sort of level statistic. And from that, you can conclude that there's a volume gap and things like that.
There's one more question.
Yeah, did I understand correctly that the P's, that the lengths of your polygon serve as momenta and the tetrahedral angle serve as coordinates?
Yeah.
Okay, and I was wondering, if you take the standard symmetric form of gravity and evaluate it on the polyhedral surface, you'll get the phase space of the symmetric structure that you showed in your first slide. I was wondering I don't know if this makes the problem more complicated or less complicated, but you can map the phase space evolution here, I think, into a flow of the metric on the interior of that surface.
So I don't know if that's interesting, but that's not something I've thought about yet. So I'm new in this way. More comments, questions? What's this thing? Chris again?